From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Guy Raz, the host of the program. This episode, two cover stories: why Asian Americans could swing the 2012 election, plus, is America losing the war on poverty?
45% of all black children born into the black middle class will end up poor.
Also, David Bowie asked if there's life on Mars. Wrong question. Should have asked about Enceladus.
If I had a little scooter like the Millennium Falcon, I could go anywhere in the solar system. Where would I go? Enceladus.
Later, the story of how a 1972 campaign debacle changed the way running mates would forever be picked.
It's hot here tonight, but I'll tell you one thing. I can take the heat, and I'm going to stay in the kitchen.
Plus, the movie J. Chandrasekhar, seen a million times.
The numbers all go to 11.
And the man who introduced reggae to the world, the legendary Jimmy Cliff, goes meta-meta.
You know if he's like Ivan, born under the Brixton sun.
That's all on this episode of Weekends and All Things Considered. There's a man in Virginia who could quite possibly hold the key to a Mitt Romney victory in November. His name? Peter Sue. Peter, tell me where you are right now.
I'm currently at the Uleok Korean restaurant in Tyson's Corner.
Tyson's Corner is in Northern Virginia in Fairfax County, a county where Asian Americans now make up 17.5% of the population. And when I spoke to Peter on Friday, he was at that restaurant where several Republicans were making a pitch to prominent Asian American community leaders.
Some are business owners, some are engineers, some are professors, and they're there to have a dialogue with Romney campaign representatives.
Peter Sue is someone making a name for himself in Republican circles because in 2009, he managed to help Virginia's Republican governor, Bob McDonnell, win his election with 60% of the Asian vote in Northern Virginia. And that was a year after Asians came out overwhelmingly in support of Democrats and Barack Obama for president. So how did Peter Sue do it? By knowing where to target those efforts.
For instance, in Northern Virginia, there are four separate Chinese schools, each with over 2,000 families. In the Korean community, the Korean churches are very strong. Most families are church-based, and therefore we were able to go into those churches. And we engaged the Vietnamese community through the Vietnamese Veterans Association, through some of the Vietnamese community elders.
Peter Sue, who is Chinese-American, also had Bob McDonnell sit down for interviews with editors at small newspapers published here in the U.S., but written entirely in Korean or Chinese or Vietnamese.
So that if there are language barriers for some of the first generation, they were able to read weekly, if not biweekly, something about Bob McDonnell.
In recent weeks on this program, we've been looking at how the two campaigns are targeting specific groups of voters, women, Latinos, Jews. Today, we're going to explore the power of Asian voters, the fastest-growing minority group in America today. Our cover story, could 2012 be the year of the Asian voter? Peter Sue says if Mitt Romney can replicate Bob McDonnell's success with Asians in Virginia, it could swing the state in his direction, which could possibly swing him the presidency.
Because in a tight election, all you need is 40,000 votes swing one way or another. And in Northern Virginia, there are 420,000 Asian Americans. If they tilt one way or another, you know, it doesn't have to be an 80-20 situation. They just have to split the votes, and that could impact either campaign in a major way.
As you know well, Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders have a wonderful culture that enriches all of America.
This is a new online video the Romney campaign is now circulating.
Today, members of your community are leaders in every part of our society.
It's a pretty straightforward appeal, nothing flashy, and nothing like the Obama campaigns. On the Obama website, you'll find a link for Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders for Obama, with a slickly produced ad that features Asian campaign workers.
As far as being an Asian American voter is concerned, President Obama is very clearly the right choice to make. He has had more Asian American cabinet members than any other president in history.
Now, here's the tricky part of the equation. Asians make up arguably the most diverse population group in America. The term Asian can include Indians, Pakistanis, Koreans, Vietnamese, Chinese, Japanese, and many others. South Asians, Indians, and Pakistanis have been mostly pro-democratic voters for the past decade. Even with prominent Republican Indian Americans in office like Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal and South Carolina's Governor Nikki Haley, polls show South Asians are more likely to vote Obama than Romney. So the battleground, at least this year, is for East Asians because, as we'll hear, a majority of them are still undecided.
There is a tradition of not appreciating the rapid demographic changes in America by certain Republican consultants.
That's Sean Steele, the former chairman of California's Republican Party. For decades, he's been looking at the coming demographic shift in America. Within a few decades, white voters will no longer be a majority. And census projections show that by the year 2050, one out of 10 Americans will be of Asian origin. And so Steele's been shouting from the rooftops about bringing Asian voters into the Republican fold. And now, more Republican strategists are starting to listen to him.
The future of the Republican Party has got to be with the Asian American community because they're generally more successful and mindful of quality education. They have a strong entrepreneurial streak with a high percentage of small businesses. And for many of the Asian immigrants, they have a healthy distrust of government. They have a good fear and loathing of what government can do to them because many of whom have come from oppressive societies.
As Sean, given that Asians supported President Obama in 2008, with 60% of the Asian vote going to President Obama, where do you see opportunities for Republicans this time around? In which states? And how can Asian voters put Romney over the top, in your view?
Well, there's about 10 states that matter that are swing states. Out of those 10 states, four have a percentage of Asian voters, reliable, consistent Asian voters, and they are Florida, Virginia, Ohio, and Nevada. Hardly anybody knows that Nevada, 7% of the voters in the last general election were Asian. Most Republicans and Democrats don't know there are thousands and thousands of Asian American media outlets in America. They're dying to get a press release. And I think the Romney folks are beginning to get the word that, you know what, 2% of Asian voters in Ohio is not a big number, but hey, whoever's going to win Ohio is going to win it by 1%. So 2% suddenly looks awfully, awfully good.
Last weekend, we heard from somebody from the Republican Jewish Coalition. He was telling us that he would be happy if Mitt Romney could get 25% of the Jewish vote. That would be the first time since 1988 Republicans received so many Jewish votes. John McCain got 35% of the Asian vote in 2008. What do you think would make this a game changer? What does that have to change to?
That's a great question. My minimal target is 60%.
60%?
There is no reason
why 60%.
Mitt Romney in this year with this economy cannot get 60%. It's there. It's ready. It's willing. Look, in very close polls, the one community that still hasn't made up their mind in terms of deciding for president are still Asian Americans, many of whom are independent voters. So just on the natch, that they're more open-minded, they're still available, and it's something that Romney needs to close the deal.
And Sean Steele is right. Many Asians are undecided. Take the members of the Korean United Methodist Church in McLean, Virginia. We spoke to many parishioners there and found a wide variety of opinions.
There are some certain social views that I identify more with the Republican, you know, just Christian views and like abortion, gay rights and things like that.
I'm a registered Republican. Last few years, I voted for the Democrat.
I'm a Democrat. All the way.
But then there's some other aspects of social programs, you know, for the immigration, helping the poor, and some government programs I think I identify closer to democratic ideas. So I go back and forth.
I came to the United States because I believe in American values, traditional values. I feel like we are losing that original faith and the value system.
I kind of think Democrat when I think of some social issues, but I'm also, I'm more Republican when it comes to economic issues and religious issues. I'm more Republican.
I will vote Obama, yeah, definitely. I think we have to consider some of the underprivileged people.
If I vote today, I'll vote for Mitt Romney because I don't see any other choices.
I feel like there's no perfect party, you know, and I don't want to say, oh, I'm this or I'm that, you know. But I care about the issues, and I think something should be done, something should be agreed on.
We heard from Yong Lim, Ki-Bon Kim, K-Rim Park, Dan Bong, and Rita Choi, all members of the Korean United Methodist Church in McLean, Virginia. Now, one interesting trend, particularly among Korean Americans who call themselves evangelicals, they may back Republican positions on things like gay marriage and abortion, but when it comes to the role of government...
Asian Americans show a very high and distinctive, I think, regard for having a bigger government with more services than do other groups.
That's Janelle Wong. She's a demographer and the director of Asian American Studies at the University of Maryland. Most Asians in America are concentrated in states that vote pro-Democrat, but that's changing too.
Because of their migration patterns into the United States, the vast majority live in blue metropolitan areas in blue states. So they're not in competitive.
New York.
California, New York, traditional immigrant gateways for Asian Americans. But we are seeing larger populations in a couple of swing states, Nevada, Virginia. They're considered top destinations for Asian Americans.
That's 8% of Nevada is Asian American, 6% of Virginia. That's a lot. I mean, that's a lot of voters in two states that are big battleground states.
Well, I've always thought that Asian Americans are really the perfect kind of new constituency for either of the two major parties. You know, we're in a polarized electorate where any edge that either party can gain by courting new voters. There's not that many new voters out there. Where are the new voters? This is one, immigrants, right? We know that 80% of Asian Americans are foreign-born, and being foreign-born represents somewhat of a barrier to getting involved in U.S. politics. But once Asian Americans become citizens, and they do so at a high rate, and they become registered voters, they actually vote at the same rates as other groups. So the biggest barriers we see are eligibility requirements. And once they move past those eligibility requirements, they do vote at pretty high rates.
Right now, neither of the two main candidates seem to really be pushing for the Asian American vote. President Obama's campaign has made some more efforts. Mitt Romney's campaign recently announced new initiatives, but still it's been relatively small efforts. Do you expect that to change in the coming months?
You know, there are reasons we just spoke about, to assume that the parties might start paying attention to this fast-growing community. At the same time, historically, the community has been the least mobilized group of the four major racial categories. So survey after survey shows that when people are asked, have you been contacted by a political party or a representative from a campaign, Asian Americans are the least likely to say yes. Why is that? Partly because it's a vicious cycle. They're seen as low propensity voters. And then parties don't want to pour their resources into a group that might not turn out to vote at a high rate or might not come out strongly for them. So 2012, I don't know if Asian Americans will change the election in 2012. But I think if the political parties started to mobilize, starting from citizenship and registration, to invest in this community early, they will likely see payoff in the future.
Janelle Wong, she's the director of Asian American Studies at the University of Maryland. By the way, just last month, President Obama said that with Virginia, he'll win the election. Both campaigns are expected to spend a disproportionate amount of money for that state's 13 electoral votes. This election, like most presidential elections really, is framed as a battle for the middle class. It's where both campaigns are aiming most of their rhetorical firepower.
And what we should do right now is give middle class families and small business owners a guarantee that their taxes will not go up next year.
Today we just got a new number from the unemployment report, and it's another hammer blow to the struggling middle class families of America.
The middle class is hard to define. In some cities, it may mean a combined household income of $40,000. In other cities, $150,000 or more. It's a group of earners that makes up the majority of the American population. But there's another huge swath of Americans that are largely ignored, the poor, and their ranks are growing. According to a recent survey by the Associated Press, the number of Americans living at or below the poverty line will soon reach its highest point since President Johnson made his famous declaration in 1964.
And this administration today, here and now, declares unconditional war on poverty in America.
Close to 16% of Americans now live at or below the poverty line, and for a family of four, that's $23,000 a year. And 100 million of us, one out of three Americans, manage to survive on a household income barely twice that amount. Our cover story today, the poverty crisis and why it's happening. From West Virginia to Wyoming to right here in Washington, D.C., food banks are reporting giant spikes in demand. In Webster Springs, West Virginia, a town we visited recently, the food pantry used to serve 30 families a month just 3 years ago. And today, 150 families in that county, and it's a county of just 9,000 people, 150 families depend on that food pantry run by Catholic Charities.
We're going to pick four different items, and it's going to be from the green beans over to the corn.
The food pantry is basically a small closet-sized room inside of a thrift shop, and it is a lifeline here. The shelves are lined with cans of vegetables and boxes of macaroni and cheese. On a recent afternoon, a young, out-of-work father in his late 20s, Josh Hickman, and his three-year-old daughter come for provisions.
Okay, how about sliced potatoes?
Yeah.
Peas?
Yeah.
Spaghetti sauce?
Yes.
Josh told us later that without that food pantry, they wouldn't be able to survive. Now, Webster Springs is a hard-hit area. Two coal mines have closed down there in the past year. The median income is around $20,000. But the crisis is also taking place right here in our nation's capital. This is the Capital Area Food Bank, where forklifts are moving huge pallets of food around a giant warehouse. This year, that food bank expects to give out 33 million pounds of food, a record. Close to 700,000 people in this region are now at risk of going hungry. Lynn Brantley runs this facility. She's been working with food pantries for four decades, and she told us that what's been happening today is a hunger crisis.
In my lifetime, I've never seen anything as bad as now. I've never seen it. It's growing into the middle class.
The face of poverty is changing. There's increasing overlap between those who used to be firmly in the middle class and those who are poor. We spoke with Angela Blackwell about the growing crisis. She runs PolicyLink. That's a research and advocacy organization that focuses on poverty. Most Americans who are poor, she says, are white. But that's also changing.
The face of poverty for the nation has changed from being white to being black and Latino. That's made a difference, too, because when people thought of poverty as being white and elderly, there was more general sympathy in the country and more commitment to do something about it. As poverty has become more racialized in the eyes of the American people, I have been very disheartened by the absence of political will to be able to really make sure that we help people get out of poverty and stay out.
It's estimated that the percentage of Americans living in poverty will increase to 15.7% this year, the highest in 50 years. Give us a sense of the gravity of this situation now.
Well, it really is terrible, because that shocking statistic really only represents the people who live below the official poverty level. It hovers around 21,000, I think, for a family of four. But you have twice that number, people who are living near poverty. Almost 100 million Americans who are living in or near poverty. And one of the really distressing things is, among the people who are living in poverty, a good number of them are living in extreme poverty, below half the poverty level. And so what this means in terms of the vastness of the numbers of people who need support in terms of food and housing and money to be able to keep their heads at least a little bit above water, it suggests that we're doing something wrong as a nation, and we need to get on the right track.
Angela, many economists say when the economy does recover, a lot of the jobs that have been lost won't come back, that there is a possibility that there will be significantly high unemployment for a long time. Could that lead to a permanent and large class of Americans who will live in poverty?
It certainly could if we don't act to prevent it, and we can, and it's not rocket science. We know now that by 2018, 45% of all jobs in this nation will require at least an associate's degree. Only 27% of African Americans, only 26% of Latinos have it. We know that by the end of this decade, the majority of young people in this country are going to be of color. Therefore, we could invest in the system of training, particularly focusing on community colleges and preparing people to go to four-year institutions and improving our high school education so that people are starting to do college work while they're still in high school and getting more engaged, more job experiences. We could do something about that. We actually have extraordinary infrastructure in this country from the manufacturing base that we once had. We need to retool it. We need to refit it. We need to make sure that it's ready for the kind of advanced manufacturing that we're seeing develop in other countries.
Well, let me ask you about economic mobility right now. If you are a child born into poverty, what is the likelihood that you will grow up out of poverty?
It's not great. If you're black, 53% of black children who are born into poverty will stay there. 32% of white children will. And so it's not good for anybody. But let me tell you something that's even more distressing. 45% of all black children born into the black middle class will end up poor. The figure for white children is 16%. Economic mobility may still be alive for some in the United States, but it is not there if you are poor.
That's Angela Blackwell. She runs the nonprofit Policy Link based out of Oakland, California. In 1988, President Ronald Reagan delivered a State of the Union address in which he declared that the war on poverty had failed.
My friends, some years ago, the federal government declared war on poverty, and poverty won. Today,
as we heard earlier, the percentage of Americans living at or below the poverty line is expected to reach its highest point since 1965. I asked Peter Edelman, a professor at Georgetown University and an expert on poverty, if Ronald Reagan was right.
No, but there's a lot to worry about.
There is a common perception that somebody who is poor or living below the poverty level is lazy and is simply living off government handouts. What is the profile of the average poor person today?
The average poor person is working, and working as hard as she or he possibly can, particularly in the recession, not able to get work or steady work. There certainly are people who make bad choices, but the fundamental question in our economy is the number of people who are doing absolutely everything they can to support their families, and they just can't make it.
Back in the 1960s, when President Johnson launched his war on poverty, it looked very different than it does today. I mean, there was real hunger and malnutrition in the United States back then.
There was, and the food stamp program is a tremendous success. So we don't see the children who have bloated bellies and sores that won't heal on their arms and legs the way Robert Kennedy did and I did when I went with him to Mississippi in 1967. But since that time, it turns out that children are the poorest age group in our country because their families, typically single moms trying to make it, can't do so because of this flood of low-wage work that we have. So it's changed since the 1960s when the elderly were our poorest age group, and now children are our poorest age group.
Peter, earlier we spoke with Congressman Steve Sutherland. He's a Republican from Florida, and he is working on legislation to tackle poverty. And we asked him about how it's working at the moment. Here's what he said. Take a listen to this.
And I would say that over five decades and $15 trillion and a rising poverty rate, that many of the programs are worthless. And there's an old saying that says, when the horse is dead, dismount. And there's a lot of poverty programs that we need to dismount from.
So he says, you know, five decades since the war on poverty was launched, $15 trillion have been spent, and there's nothing to show for. Does he have a point?
That's an old refrain. We hear that over and over again. It's analyzing the problem wearing a complete blindfold. The problem is how the economy functions for low-income people. The public policy that we have is working. Social Security, the income effects of Medicare and Medicaid, food stamps, earned income tax credit. We're keeping 40 million people out of poverty. And we would have poverty at 86 million instead of the 46 million we have if we didn't have those programs.
Peter Edelman, he's a professor of law at Georgetown University and the author most recently of So Rich, So Poor, Why It's So Hard to End Poverty in America. One half of all jobs in the U.S. today now pay less than $35,000 a year. Adjusted for inflation, one of the lowest rates for American workers in five decades. At this precise moment, a spacecraft is speeding toward Mars. If all goes to plan, the Mars Science Laboratory, nicknamed Curiosity, will land gently on Mars at 10:31 Pacific time tonight. Now, if you're hoping to see live pictures of the landing, forget about it. It'll only send radio signals indicating whether it was successful and only after it's all over. And why? Sounds like a question for NPR's Joe Palca, who is tracking that story from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena.
When you spent $2.5 billion on a mission to Mars, you kind of want to hear from the spacecraft once in a while.
We have two ways to communicate to and from the rover.
That's Richard Kornfeld. He's a senior engineer on the Mars landing team. The rover's entry, descent, and landing lasts for a total of 7 minutes. During that time, the rover must slow down from 13,000 miles an hour to a dead stop when it touches down on the surface of Mars. The two ways of communicating Kornfeld is talking about include one radio system that can transmit a signal directly from the spacecraft to Earth, and another that requires the radio signal to be relayed through satellites that are orbiting Mars.
We currently have three orbiters around Mars. One is the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter.
There's also NASA's Mars Odyssey. The third is the European Space Agency's Mars Express spacecraft. Mars Odyssey can take a signal from the rover and send it directly back to Earth. The other two satellites have to record the rover's transmissions and send them to Earth at a later time. Kornfeld says the direct-to-Earth signal can't provide much information during the landing, what the engineers at JPL affectionately call the 7 minutes of terror. All it can do is send tones.
There are a set of about 256 tones, and each tone means something specific.
Things like the heat shield is warming up, or the parachute is deployed. And there's one other problem during the landing.
Unfortunately, Earth sets when the rover is on the parachute.
Once Earth goes below the horizon of Mars and the rover can no longer see it, the direct-to-Earth signal no longer works. So the plan is to rely on a relayed signal from Mars Odyssey to let engineers know whether the landing was a success. Kornfeld says the other thing that you have to keep in mind is that radio signals take a while to go from Mars to Earth, even traveling at the speed of light.
A signal on landing day takes almost 14 minutes to travel.
That's why the rover is on its own for the landing.
Even if you wanted to help the rover, I mean, it would be 28 minutes round trip for the radio signal, so and the whole thing lasts 7 minutes.
That is correct. In fact, by the time we'll hear the first signals from the rover as it hits the atmosphere, the landing will have been over already by 7 minutes.
That's a little hard to wrap your mind around.
The whole landing takes 7 minutes. There is 14 minutes of the signal it takes to travel down to Earth. So by the time you get the first signals, that show is actually over at Mars already.
Not to be too Earth-centric about it, the truth is there's no one on Mars to watch. So the show won't be over until 10:31 Pacific time here on Earth. Joe Palca, NPR News.
Now, one of the things the rover will be looking for are organic molecules that could at least indicate whether there was once life on Mars. But if searching for life in outer space is the goal, many scientists now say we might have better luck elsewhere, specifically one of Saturn's moons called Enceladus. NASA planetary scientist Chris McKay is working on a proposal to send a mission to Enceladus, which is more or less a frozen rock.
Think of it as a small world or a large snowball. It's only a couple hundred miles in diameter, but it's particularly interesting because there's a geyser coming out of the south pole of Enceladus.
Why is Enceladus so potentially exciting?
It's really exciting because of this jet of water. It's originating from what we're pretty sure is a subsurface liquid sea or lake, if you will. And most exciting to me, that jet has in it, in addition to water, organic compounds that make up life.
So if we are looking for life out there, what you're suggesting is that we should be headed towards Enceladus.
That's right. Of all the places in our solar system, it's the only place I know of where right now we can check all the boxes for habitability. Water, energy, carbon, nitrogen, check, 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 check.
So why the focus on Mars?
It was the first world we knew of where there was water or had been water other than the Earth. So Mars is still special, but it's in a category by itself because it's a place that humans want to go to.
So say we wanted to send a spacecraft to Enceladus to dig around a little bit, to check it out. How long would it take to get there?
Well, it's quite a long trip. It's 7 years.
7 years?
So that's how long the Cassini spacecraft took to fly to Saturn. And the data we have on Enceladus came from Cassini. 7 years, it's the trip time.
And if we wanted to actually examine that material, I guess it would take 14 years, right? Because it would have to go there for 7 years, spend a couple weeks there, and then 7 years coming back.
That's right. And it's probably a year there, orbiting Saturn, collecting the material, scooping up stuff. The only easy part of the whole mission is that the geyser is coming out in space, and we just fly through it and collect our samples. It's almost like there's a big sign on Enceladus that says, free samples, take one.
What would Enceladus look like if we landed a craft there?
It would look like a big, huge field of ice. So Enceladus is not the fascinating geological world that Mars is. What's really interesting about Enceladus is only the fact that underneath that ice, there's a lake, and in that lake, we know there is an energy source and there's organic material. So Enceladus is sort of a one-trick pony. But if you're just interested in the search for life, then Enceladus has got to be number one on my list.
Number one on your list.
That's right. I was once asked if I had a little scooter like the Millennium Falcon, I could go anywhere in the solar system. Where would I go? What would I punch in first? Enceladus. Fly through that plume.
If we eventually did get a craft on Enceladus, and we did discover that there is life there, what do you think that life would look like?
Well, that to me is the important question. If we find that there's life on Enceladus, and if that life is different than Earth life, then that's fascinating. That allows us for the first time to see what other ways there are to do life besides the DNA for all life on Earth. What are the possibilities? They could be as simple as Earth life, or it could be so different that we can't even recognize it.
That's Chris McKay. He's a planetary scientist for NASA. He's finalizing a proposal to start a new discovery mission to Saturn's moon Enceladus. Chris McKay, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Sometime before the end of this month, when Republicans hold their convention in Tampa, Mitt Romney will almost certainly announce his vice presidential running mate. And right now, there's a good chance the finalists for that spot are wading through mountains of paperwork and answering deeply personal questions, questions about their finances, their past statements, friendships, and medical histories. And a lot of that tedious process has to do with something that happened 40 years ago this summer. It's the subject of a new book called The 18-Day Running Mate, written by Joshua Glasser, and it tells the story of George McGovern's fateful decision to place Thomas Eagleton on the Democratic ticket. In the middle of July 1972, thousands of delegates arrived in Miami for the Democratic convention. Now, while these conventions are, at least today, more or less scripted and choreographed events, back in 72, that was not the case.
We went to the convention very uncertain as to whether or not we could sustain our delegations.
That's Gary Hart, former Colorado senator and presidential candidate. In 1972, he was George McGovern's campaign manager. Now, McGovern was the insurgent candidate. He wasn't the establishment's choice. And on his road to the nomination, he managed to alienate the party's old guard, people like Chicago Mayor Richard Daley. So, as Joshua Glasser explains in his book, McGovern needed a running mate who could unite the Democrats.
All their polling told them that Ted Kennedy was the guy they needed on the ticket. If they had him on the ticket, they would have a reasonable shot of actually beating Nixon come the fall.
Watching Ted Kennedy these days, working his way through a crush of admiring Democrats, one could get the impression he's running for something. He insists, of course, he isn't.
Kennedy was the party's torchbearer, an unapologetic liberal who railed against the Vietnam War.
Still, the war goes on for the 415 American prisoners of war held in Hanoi. And they must be asking, what happened to the promise to end the war in 1968?
When George McGovern's team arrived to Miami for the convention, the nomination wasn't assured, and so the campaign hadn't really started the process of looking for a running mate. All along, according to Gary Hart, McGovern assumed Ted Kennedy would be that man.
And he thought he could persuade Senator Kennedy to do it, and up until the very, very last moment.
But Kennedy kept saying no. And so the day the convention began, July 13th, 1972, McGovern reached out to others, his Senate colleagues like Gaylord Nelson from Wisconsin and Abe Ribicaw from Connecticut, and they also said no. But McGovern was working against a deadline. The nominating process was set to begin at 5 p.m. that evening, and he had to pick a VP nominee by then.
I think under the pressure of time, he called Senator Kennedy back and said, look, Ted, I've got to make a decision. Are you going to be with me? And Senator Kennedy said, no, I don't think so. That's when we went to Eagleton.
Gary Hart says Thomas Eagleton wasn't even on the initial shortlist, but he was an up-and-comer, the youngest ever attorney general in Missouri history, and by 1972, a U.S. senator who made a name for himself as a fiery opponent of the Vietnam War.
I came back from Indochina convinced that the president has taken a risk by allowing American soldiers and prestige to be held hostage to Saigon survival.
NPR's Ken Rudin recently wrote about that 1972 race on his blog, The Political Junkie, and he described how, on the campaign trail, McGovern had alienated big labor and working-class Catholics.
McGovern, with real big trouble with Catholic voters, with labor support, looked at Tom Eagleton as almost like the perfect kind of candidate.
Thomas Eagleton was a devout Catholic and a strong opponent of abortion. And on that first day of the convention, July 13th, McGovern called Eagleton to offer him the spot. They spoke for about 2 minutes over the phone. Again, here's Gary Hart.
We went over names casually, didn't do any, quote, background checking. It wasn't mandated in those days as it is now. Certainly after 72, it came to be mandated, but people trusted other people's word.
The feeling back then was it's beneath a presidential nominee to ask somebody about health issues or personal problems, or do you have a drinking problem?
That turned out to be George McGovern's biggest mistake. And within a few days, rumors started to circulate, beginning with a call to McGovern's headquarters in South Dakota.
And the anonymous caller had said, check into Senator Eagleton's background. He has a complicated medical background.
As Hart remembers it, neither he nor McGovern's top aide, Frank Mankiewicz, knew anything.
Calls were made to the Eagleton staff to say, we got this call, what does it mean? And the response we got back was, we'll check into it and let you know.
Within hours, the McGovern campaign was getting those details. On three occasions in the 1960s, Eagleton was hospitalized for depression. And each time, he underwent electroshock treatment to help ease it. Several reporters were already onto the story, and so the McGovern campaign made a strategic decision. They would preempt any scoops and make those revelations public themselves.
This was the height of the Cold War, and the key here wasn't how do we feel about mental illness or therapy or anything like that. The key was, quote, finger on the button.
And that phrase, finger on the button, began to dog the McGovern campaign once those revelations about Eagleton's condition became public. The initial strategy was to address what happened, and Eagleton was forthcoming.
On three occasions in my life, I have voluntarily gone into hospitals as a result of nervous exhaustion and fatigue. As a younger man, I must say that I drove myself too far, and I pushed myself terribly, terribly hard, long hours, day and night.
But despite his best efforts to address what had happened in an honest way, the pressure began to mount. Democratic Party stalwarts started to call on Eagleton to step down. So did a New York Times editorial. At first, McGovern stood by his running mate.
It's hot here tonight, and Eagleton perspires even on Christmas Eve. But I'll tell you one thing. I can take the heat, and I'm going to stay in the kitchen.
At every campaign stop, Eagleton was asked whether he'd remain on the ticket, and each time, he was defiant.
I'm not quitting. I'm not getting out. We're going to win this election, and I'm going to be the next vice president of the United States.
But as the story dragged on, the polls began to look ominous for George McGovern, and many people on the campaign staff, including Gary Hart, were frustrated.
And the hard part was we couldn't get the data. We couldn't get the medical reports. We couldn't talk to his doctors.
So McGovern, under increasing pressure, asked to speak to Eagleton's psychiatrists. Here's author Joshua Glasser again.
Eagleton gets two of his doctors on the phone and lets McGovern speak with the doctors. And McGovern, based on those conversations, makes the medical decision that Eagleton can't go, that based on what they told him, Eagleton was too much of a risk to have his finger potentially on the metaphorical button.
Just 18 days after he was picked to run with George McGovern, Thomas Eagleton arrived in Washington to hold a press conference.
Ladies and gentlemen, I will not divide the Democratic Party, which already has too many divisions. Therefore, tomorrow morning, I will write to the chairman of the Democratic Party, withdrawing my candidacy.
99 days later, Richard Nixon would defeat George McGovern in a landslide. It was the widest margin of victory in the popular vote in presidential history. Afterwards, McGovern spent another decade in the Senate. Thomas Eagleton went on to serve two distinguished terms as Missouri senator. He died in 2007.
The way Eagleton handled himself during those 18 days was very admirable, and it earned him tremendous respect from the people of Missouri. They didn't like the way he appeared to be treated by McGovern. And he was a very, very able and respected public servant.
You can read more about those traumatic days in Joshua Glasser's new book. It's called 18 Day Running Mate. All summer long in the program, we've been asking people who work in film to talk about the movie that changed their life, including this one from one of the men behind Super Troopers.
Hi, my name's Jay Chandrasekhar, and I'm a writer-director. And the film I've chosen, which I have seen a million times, is This is Spinal Tap, directed by Rob Reiner, and it stars Christopher Guest, Michael McKean, and Harry Shearer. You know, I first saw this film in the 80s when I was in college. I was one of two guys who had a VCR in my fraternity house. I would show up and there'd be a bunch of guys sitting in my room watching some movie. And so I watched Spinal Tap, you know, hundreds of times.
We are Spinal Tap from the UK. You must be the USA.
So the plot of Spinal Tap is, it's sort of meant to be a classic rock documentary, or as Marty DeBurgi says, a rockumentary.
I wanted to capture the sights, the sounds, the smells of a hard-working rock band on the road.
And it's going to follow the American tour of what was at one point a bigger rock band, you know, and now they're sort of a little bit on the downslope.
I have a small piece of bad news. The gig is canceled. It says Memphis show canceled due to lack of advertising funds.
The accents are flawless. The music is really good. The first song they ever played together, which is All the Way Home, and they sing an a cappella version of it.
If she's not on the 519, then I'm gonna know what sorrow means, and I'm gonna cry, cry, cry all the way home.
I mean, it's beautiful. It's like it's as good as any of the bands that came out of England in the 60s.
Fairly simple. It's about six words in the whole song. You know,
sounds like
repeating them over and over again.
My favorite scene when I first saw it, and it continues to be my favorite scene, it's David St. Hubbin's girlfriend Janine has taken over management of the band. And so this is sort of their first gig with her in charge. She ends up booking them on an Air Force base for an At Ease weekend. And they show up at the Air Force base, and Fred Willard is the Air Force liaison.
May I start by saying how thrilled we are to have you here. We are such fans of your music and all of your records.
Right.
I'm not speaking of yours personally, but the whole genre, the rock and roll and so many.
Fred Willard goes on the most amazing riff. He lays out six or seven deadpan jokes in a row, and he ends with,
"These haircuts wouldn't pass military muster, believe me. Although I shouldn't talk, my hair's getting a little shaggy, too. Better not get too close to you, they'll think I'm part of the band. I'm joking, of course. Shall we go in and I'll show you around?"
You know, he could have stopped anywhere in that string of jokes and you'd say, yeah, that's a joke. But he ends with, "I'm joking, of course," and it's just, I don't know, I just love it.
And I have just one request. Would you play a couple of slow numbers so I can dance?
Working on a sex farm.
Spinal Tap influenced me, I think, specifically in making me really try to pay attention to tone. A lot of comedy films, there's the opinion, well, if it's funny, put it in. But I think you have to be more disciplined in that. I think in a film that's supposed to last an hour and a half, I think you have to really pay attention to what kind of movie you're making, what is the audience experiencing, and does this joke fit with this joke? So it requires that you monitor what jokes go in the movie. And I think Rob Reiner and those guys really, really paid attention to it.
That's writer-director Jay Chandrasekhar talking about the movie he could watch a million times. This is Spinal Tap. Chandrasekhar's new film, The Baby Makers, opened in theaters this weekend.
Lope.
I have a small piece of bad news. The gig is canceled. It says Memphis show canceled due to lack of advertising funds.
The accents are flawless. The music is really good. The first song they ever played together, which is All the Way Home, and they sing an a cappella version of it.
If she's not on the 519, then I'm gonna know what sorrow means, and I'm gonna cry, cry, cry all the way home.
I mean, it's beautiful. It's like it's as good as any of the bands that came out of England in the 60s.
Fairly simple. It's about six words in the whole song. You know,
sounds like
I've beaten them over and over again.
My favorite scene when I first saw it, and it continues to be my favorite scene, it's David St. Hubbin's girlfriend, Janine, has taken over management of the band. And so this is sort of their first gig with her in charge. She ends up booking them on an Air Force base for an At Ease weekend. And they show up at the Air Force Base, and Fred Willard is the Air Force liaison.
May I start by saying how thrilled we are to have you here. We are such fans of your music and all of your records.
Right.
I'm not speaking of yours personally, but the whole genre of the rock and roll and stuff.
Fred Willard goes on the most amazing riff. He lays out six or seven deadpan jokes in a row, and he ends with...
These haircuts wouldn't pass military muster, believe me. Although I shouldn't talk, my hair's getting a little shaggy too. Better not get too close to you, they'll think I'm part of the band. I'm joking, of course. Shall we go in and I'll show you around?
You know, he could have stopped anywhere in that string of jokes and you'd say, yeah, that's a joke. But he ends with, I'm joking, of course, and it's just, I don't know, I just love it.
And I have just one request. Would you play a couple of slow numbers so I can dance?
Waiting on a sex bomb.
Smile Tap influenced me, I think, specifically in making me really try to pay attention to tone. A lot of comedy films, there's the opinion, well, if it's funny, put it in. But I think you have to be more disciplined in that. I think in a film that's supposed to last an hour and a half, I think you have to really pay attention to what kind of movie you're making, what is the audience experiencing, and does this joke fit with this joke? So it requires that you monitor what jokes go in the movie. And I think Rob Reiner and those guys really, really paid attention to it.
That's writer-director Jay Chandrasekhar talking about the movie he could watch a million times. This is Spinal Tap. Chandrasekhar's new film, The Baby Makers, opened in theaters this weekend. And it's time now for music. The two artists most responsible for bringing reggae to the world stage, Bob Marley, of course, and this man, Jimmy Cliff.
So as sure as the sun will shine, I'm gonna get my share of what's mine. And then the harder they come, the harder they fall, one and all.
Jimmy Cliff's best known for the 1972 film The Harder They Come, both as its lead actor and for the three now legendary songs included on its soundtrack. But after that, the world embraced Bob Marley as reggae's ambassador, and Jimmy Cliff more or less worked in his shadow. But his new album sounds like a man claiming what was rightfully his all along.
One more, one more.
Jimmy Cliff's latest album is called Rebirth. He says it refers to both the rebirth of the planet and the rebirth of his career.
I'm at the point where I'm taking my career to a next level. It kind of started out when the new millennium began. And up to, let's take like from 2010, when I received the induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, that was like a stepping stone up to the next ladder. I had started writing this album without knowing I was going to call it Rebirth, but I had quite a bit of the songs before. So that's about the rebirth of Jimmy Cliff's career, but the rebirth of the planet is also about the new time that we're coming into. We're coming into a new time when all the old laws and ways are breaking down. We're coming into a new time, and I express all of this in some of the songs on the new album.
Looking at the world today, I am implored to say, so much war and poverty, while few enjoy prosperity. They say the world is spinning around, I say the world is upside down.
It was really you as a sort of the singular figure who introduced reggae to much of the world in the late 60s and in the early 70s. And this record almost sounds like a reintroduction of the music that you made back in the early days.
Yes, and the reason for that is, as a rebirth, one has to go back to point zero to move forward again. And so that is what we did. We recorded the music with the same instruments that we had used back in the days, the same style that we used to record, which is everyone recording at the same time, as opposed to today with one person do a part and another part.
This was done live to tape.
Yes, yes, exactly.
Just like back in the old days in Kingston.
Back in the old days, it's how we used to do it then, yes.
1962, Orange Street, Kingston, Jamaica. I sang my song for Leslie Kong.
Indeed, you sing about those old days in the song, reggae music. This is really a song about your life.
Yes, it is a song about my life, my career, as well as incorporating reggae music. You know, how it came about. I sort of touch on a few of the high points of reggae music which propelled it to the world.
1971, a new era begun. With the holiday come showing where reggae music came from. There was Winston Wright, Jackie Jackson, Ox Brown, and Winston Brennan. Now reggae music is worldwide, there's nothing to hide. Oh, reggae music gonna make me feel good. Reggae music gonna make me feel all right now.
I'm speaking with reggae pioneer Jimmy Cliff. His new record is called Rebirth. Jimmy Cliff, many people were introduced to you and to your music in the 1972 film The Harder They Come. You portrayed Ivanhoe Martin, and there's sort of a full circle now on this record. You sing a version of the Clash song Guns of Brixton, which has that line.
Well, you know, if he's like Ivan.
He feels like Ivan, born under the Brixton sun.
His game is called surviving at the end of the harder they come.
His game is called surviving at the end of the harder they come. That film was influential on that band, and here you are. You're covering that song, Guns of Brixton.
Yes, and one of the reasons for covering that song was to show and remind people the influence that reggae music had on punk music.
When they kick out your front door, how you gonna come? With your hands on your head or on the trigger of your gun?
What do you sort of ascribe that influence of reggae on punk to? I mean, how did that happen?
Oh, because reggae and punk addresses the same kind of issues, political, social issues. And I think that is the essence of the connection right there.
What music do you listen to now that gets you excited, that sort of gives you the sense that this can really change the world?
I'm not so sure, but The kind of music that I'm listening to now is music to keep current with what's going on. Someone like Katy Perry, I like her writing because I listen to music as a songwriter. And, you know, I like a lot of her songs. Like Firework is a song that I think I could write.
I got to tell you, Katy Perry is not the one I would would have thought that Jimmy Cliff would have picked.
Right, right. Because she sings about relationships, you know,
yeah.
or Adele. She sings about relationships.
Does Katy Perry know that Jimmy Cliff is a Katy Perry fan?
She knows now. Yes.
This has been a pretty remarkable last 2 or 3 years for you. You've been inducted in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and now you have this new album that is getting incredibly rave reviews. Things are going great for you. How does success now compare to what it was, you know, back in like 1972 at the beginning of your career?
There are goals that I had set out for myself. I have accomplished some of them. However, other parts of my goals have not been completed, because the first thing I wanted to be was an actor. I am on my way now to getting the Oscar. I have not done that yet. I am on my way now to making a string of number one hits all over the world. I have not done that yet. But success has different meanings to me. For example, when someone come up to me and say, you know, I was a dropout in school and I heard your song, You Can Get It If You Really Want. That song made me go back to school and now I am a teacher and I use your song to my students. You can get it if you really want. That for me is a big success. So success has different meanings to me.
That's reggae legend Jimmy Cliff. His new record is called Rebirth. Thank you so much. It's been an honor speaking with you.
Thank you very, very much indeed. You'll succeed at
last. We've got a video from one of Jimmy Cliff's performances this summer, covering music across his 50-year career. That's at our website, nprmusic.org. You must be a win and lose, you've got to get your share. Got your mind set on a dream. You can get it, don't want it to seem. Weekending August 5th, 2012, that's the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered. Our program was directed this week by Lauren Silverman and Phil Harrell, with help from Amy Held, Brent Bachman, Sanaz Meshkinpour, Beenish Ahmed, and Lily Percy. Michael Tomsic is our intern, Mathoni Maturi is our senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Guy Raz. Catch us next weekend with another podcast or listen live Saturdays and Sundays, and thanks for listening.